I'm going to be talking a little bit about some foundational aspects of the self-force problem. This is something that's been studied now for more than 100 years, going back to analysis of charged electrical spheres back at the beginning of the 20th century. So given that this has such a long history, I can't possibly give a comprehensive review of it. So I'm just going to try and give basically a flavor, in particular physical flavor of, I thought he said I need both. Oh, okay. Sorry. Okay, so I'm giving a, trying to give a physical flavor of the field. There's gonna be a lot of things that are left out, but hopefully you'll forgive me for that. But the things that I am going to cover are basically talk a little bit about what is the self force. It's not necessarily a trivial thing. Then what does it tend to do in typical cases? The seemingly trivial question of what is a world line, because a world line is not a world line in most self-force problems, or it is not a collection of points in a manifold, time-like collection of points in a manifold, as you learn in elementary relativity. Okay, then after that, I'm going to say a little bit of what is actually known about the self-force, and I'm going to mainly take the perspective of describing things in terms of a singular self-field, and singular is in quotes because it's not actually singular if you have a non-singular object, but I'm going to describe what its effects are and then go into the standard lore of Mises-Tocqueville equation and so on. Okay, so what is the self-force problem? As the name implies, it's basically just you have some object that couples to some long-range field, say electromagnetism or gravity or scalar field or whatever, and you want to know how that field, how the field that the object produces affects its motion or affects its bulk properties in some way. So you could consider, for example, how it affects its angular momentum. There are a couple things that the field does, the most well-known of which is that it radiates, it can radiate energy and momentum. So if you have some electrical charge here and you shake it back and forth, you're going to get radiation, and that radiation, the energy for that radiation has to come from the force that's pushing the particle, and so there must be a radiation reaction force. But that's not the entirety of the self-force. There are other things that happen as well, and in fact, the fields, of course, have energy associated with them just as they sit, and in fact, there's bound energy that can change. It's not radiated to infinity, so you can actually reversibly transfer energy to and from the field and the matter. And furthermore, since the fields have energy, they also have inertia. So there's sort of three different things going on, and it turns out that actually the equations of motion for the self-force on a charged particle is somewhat similar to the equations governing this very simple mechanical system, where this is some block, and it's connected by springs to two other blocks, and you have some dampers here. And these blocks here basically have act like the inertia of the field, and the dampers are like the radiation that make you lose energy as you accelerate. And then the center of mass motion of the centerpiece is basically has a very similar equation to the center of mass motion of a charged particle. Okay, so what does this tend to do? Cases that people usually consider are things that are very close in some sense to a test particle case, where you have a very large object and a much smaller object, and you want to know how the small object moves around the large object. But you don't want to consider it to be quite a test particle, but have a little bit of interaction with its own field. When you do that, you usually get that trajectories, if they're not already circular, if you're in some orbit, they will become circular typically, and then they will decay and spiral inwards. So some kind of amusing example of this is a charged particle orbiting a central charge here that's rotating, so it has a magnetic dipole moment that's pointed up, and the funky green orbit is just ordinary Lorentz force. So that's what happens without self-force, that's a test particle trajectory. than if you add cell force that very quickly processes and decays to this triangular looking thing, which is a lower energy orbit in this weird system. And then that very quickly decays down to a circular orbit, and then that spirals inward and inward, and I cut it off before it hit the center. So that's sort of the dissipated part of the cell force. Another thing that can happen is that you can have frequency shifts and things like that. So these are conservative effects, as you might call them. And then lastly, as I said, the fields have inertia, and so you effectively renormalize or change what looks like the linear momentum or the angular momentum of a body due to the linear and angular momentum of the field that it carries around with it as it moves. Okay, so why study this? As I said, the problem's more than 100 years old, so there have been many things that people have looked into, most of which people don't care about anymore or have given up on. So one of the first of these is that charged particles with cell force were considered as models for elementary particles in classical physics. Nobody thinks that that is a good idea anymore. The problem was also studied to try and get guidance to fix infinities in quantum field theory, because you get very similar infinities if you try to consider point particles in classical field theory. Next was a hope that all of inertia could be treated as just this energy of the field. We now expect that some inertia comes from energy of the field, but probably not all of it. So that's still the interpretation in quantum field theory, I believe. There's also been a lot of weird stuff that's come out of this, like runaway solutions and pre-acceleration and other things that have classically been very important in motivating what goes on in this field. But basically, these are things that come out if you don't treat the problem properly. But this has led to a lot of motivation of, well, what is the fundamental structure of classical field theory as coupled to matter and things like that. Lastly, and most mundanely, but probably most applicable to this conference, is just cell force is one more thing you have to solve if you want to figure out motion in some extreme systems. And one of those extreme systems is, for example, an extreme mass ratio binary of compact objects like black holes, for example. Okay, so why is this hard? First of all, there are multiple length scales. If you have this model sort of system of a large object and a small object orbiting it, you have very complicated fields near the small object that vary on the scale of that object. But then you also have fields that vary over the orbital scale, which is much larger. And it's hard to treat all those things simultaneously. Next, point particles are usually introduced in mechanics as a way to simplify life. They don't simplify life, at least not until you've derived a whole bunch of things. You don't have any consistent solutions for ordinary field theories coupled to point particles. So you have to either make up extra rules for that to work, or you have to do something else. Despite that point particles don't work, you expect that a point particle looking limit should almost work, meaning that you should have some universal behavior where you don't care about the internal structure of the object as you go to some particular limit. But if you just take some, say, particular fluid model of a ball with some internal structure or whatever, and you calculate what happens to its motion, you're not going to figure out what happens to some ball that is made out of a different kind of fluid, for example. So you don't really get much insight into the universal behavior of any of these kinds of effects if you just look at very explicit calculations. So it's hard to do things that are sufficiently general to really capture this universality that people expect should be there and indeed is there. Also, there are some issues with what exactly is a self field, particularly if you have a nonlinear theory like general relativity. So what does it mean to say it's the field only of the body itself, and do you really care about going out of your way to define such a thing? And then what really should be computed? If you have some object that's not a point particle, you need to try to figure out what exactly it is that you want to compute about it, because you don't want to try to figure out all of its internal details. All right, so continuing with that, what is motion? or what is motion in the sense that we'd like to discuss it. The full theory here is really given by PDEs. It's continuum mechanics plus whatever field equations you have. So if you have a fluid ball in general relativity, it's Navier-Stokes equations plus Einstein's equation. Those are not easy to solve, as I'm sure everybody knows. You could just specify initial data on a hypersurface and put things on a computer and evolve everything forward in time and see what happens. That's difficult, does not give you any idea of how general your solution is. And sometimes it's, of course, a very good thing to do, and sometimes you want something with more physical insight. So what else is possible? You can try to, as I said, point particles don't work, so you could try to introduce axioms to make them work. That's not a derivation, that's a physical guess, essentially, of what's going on. The alternative is to try to abstract a real object, say a star or a black hole, to a single world line plus perhaps a collection of multiple moments along that world line. So you have a mass and angular momentum, perhaps a quadrupole moment, and so on. Of course, the question is, which world line do you choose? Whatever you do, your definition is going to be non-local. So if, for example, you have some extended matter distribution, you might define a world line by doing an integral over a space-like slice or something like that. And when you do that, you're always going to care about what's happening throughout that slice. So you can't say that the dynamics of this world line depend only on where the world line is. In fact, it depends on this whole extended region. So because of that, the causality properties of any of these objects are going to be very strange, at least if you define things non-perturbatively and you look at their exact causality properties. In various limits, of course, you can get things that are really just particle mechanics in the Newtonian sense, where you have a position and an initial velocity, and that gives you the evolution. But more generally, you can't possibly expect that. Whatever you do, though, you do have what's really an effective field theory for the object. You're taking some complicated thing with all kinds of internal degrees of freedom, and you're abstracting it to a single world line plus a handful of time-dependent tensors along that world line. So you have to be very careful with your interpretation of these things, and don't take any of them too seriously unless you really know what your definitions are. All right, what is an example of a world line as it's used in self-force calculations? Usually in the gravitational self-force problem, you have to do something which is intrinsically perturbative. So you basically look outside of a body and try to figure out where it looks like the gravitational field is coming from if it were happened to be sourced by a point particle. So a little bit more precisely, you have two manifolds typically in perturbation theory. You have your full one, and this is, say, the world tube of your object or some world tube around a black hole. But then you also have your background manifold with a metric g bar, and you have a gauge that maps between them. What you can do is write down Einstein's equation, the linearized Einstein equation, in this background manifold, and the linearized Einstein equation does admit point particles, unlike the full one. So you could just write down the metric perturbations as a function of this world line, gamma, of some hypothetical point particle. And then the idea is that you say the trajectory of your object over here is given by this world line if, under this gauge map, the two metrics agree. In some approximate sense, if you don't get too close to this body and you don't get too close to anything else in the universe. So there's a lot of gymnastics in what I just said. Again, I'm just trying to impress upon you that world lines are complicated things as used in perturbation theory, especially in general relativity. There's a very nice review of various things that have been done in Adam Pound's paper on self-force. Okay, one alternative thing you can do is sort of a more physical world line, if you try to define things non-perturbatively. So you start out with some world tube. This doesn't work for black holes, but it does work for, say, a star. and you want to try to choose some world line in there without making any reference to perturbation theory. So this is something that you can do, but of course, you need to decide which world line you want to choose, and you want it to have nice properties, you want to hope that it's representative of the overall motion in some sense, both of which are difficult things to prove, or to motivate at least. But one common choice is to basically define linear and angular momenta for such an object, and then say that the angular momentum is orthogonal to the linear momentum. This means, really, that the mass dipole moment vanishes with respect to an observer with 0-3 momentum. So in the rest frame of the body, there's no mass dipole moment. This is really just the Newtonian definition of center of mass generalized with non-trivial momentum. I'm going to be talking a lot more about non-self-force related consequences of that definition tomorrow, but it's a pretty standard thing, actually. Anyway, you're left with some world line that it's simple to interpret because it is a real world line. You don't need to go back and forth between different manifolds and introduce gauges to say what it means. But it's not useful for black holes, and it's arguably not extremely useful for highly compact matter distributions either, because you don't necessarily want to dig a hole inside your neutron star and try to figure out what's going on in there, but you really care only about what's outside of it. But it is a useful alternative interpretation, and this has been used in the scalar and electromagnetic self-force problems successfully, where you have some fixed background space-time, and it's also been partially implemented in the gravitational case, so there are some subtleties with it there, but it mostly works. All right, so whatever definition of world line you want to use, you can put the basic results of the self-force calculations of what are the dynamics of this strange thing that you defined into a fairly simple form in terms of what's typically called the singular self-field. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what that means in a Newtonian context to make it very clear and very simple. So you define this phi s, say you have some Newtonian body with mass density rho, you define some phi s given by this expression, which is what you would usually call the self-field in a Newtonian context. Of course, this is not a singular field if rho is not itself singular. So that name arises from what happens if you go to a point particle case, but I'm not going to be considering that here. Anyway, if you consider the force on a body due to this field, which is just given by rho times grad phi, as you learn in freshman or high school physics, this is, of course, zero due to, say, Newton's third law or just direct calculation or whatever you want to use. So this is useful to pay attention to because this is most of the field that causes problems. This is the thing that gets very large if you try to make a small size approximation. This is the thing that has that varies very rapidly on small length scales. So it's really nice to try to just get rid of it at the outset and only deal with this difference field, which is the full field minus the singular piece. And this thing is, I'm calling it H here because it's homogeneous. It satisfies the homogeneous field equation in the neighborhood of the body. And as might be expected from this, in most cases, it does not vary very much over the scale of the body. So more particularly, as I just said, phi h has various properties. It's homogeneous near the body. That's useful for various things. It's relatively simple to compute. You can do this either by sort of an angle averaging procedure, which is similar to what appears in various axioms that have been introduced to try to compute self-forces in the point particle case. But basically, this is just a direct use of Green's functions. This is the surface term. The phi s here is the volume term, which you've subtracted out. But most importantly, as I said, this thing is approximately constant inside a body most of the time. So this is a constant vector. You can pull it out. You have grad phi h times integral of rho. Integral of rho is m. And you get back basically a point particle moving in the field phi h is your force that's left over. And this Newtonian case, of course, phi h would just be the field of all the other bodies in the universe, and it's very easy to compute. All right, why does phi s contribute no force? This is, as I said, trivial in this Newtonian case, but it's a little bit less trivial when you go to the relativistic case. And if you expand this thing here for the force due to phi s, you get this, and then you can rewrite it as a sum of a gradient on gradient with respect to x plus a gradient with respect to x prime averaged. And this thing here is really just a Lie derivative of the Green function, the Green function being 1 over x minus x prime here, with respect to some translational killing field of your Euclidean space. So usually people don't think of anything that's sophisticated in Newtonian mechanics, but it's useful to do that when you go beyond Newtonian mechanics. So anyway, a Lie derivative of the Green function with respect to a translation is going to vanish because your Green function is translation invariant. So translation invariance gives you zero self-force. You can do the same calculation and show that rotational invariance gives you zero self-torque. Doesn't look like this can be generalized to relativistic systems, especially to asymmetric spacetimes, but in fact it can. So the basic ideas were first laid out by Detweiler and Whiting in 2003, and then further developed by Eric Poisson in his Living Reviews article. The idea is basically to define a special Green function, GS, generalizing this thing. And this is going to work for scalar fields, for electromagnetic fields, or for linearized gravity. But there are two things new that happen in the relativistic case that occur because you're adding an extra dimension of time. One of these is that this self-field, which in the Newtonian case had zero contribution to the motion, now contributes an effective momentum. And of course, it's also not the full self-field anymore. There's also going to be radiation that is not associated with the particle and that just leaves it eventually. So these are two of the main self-force effects that you want to have. And in fact, you want to subtract out the thing that does not give you radiation, essentially. There are also some conservative effects hidden in the non-singular portion of the self-field in general. But in any case, this was originally essentially an axiomatic approach. It was developed to try to understand what's happening if you have point particles. So as I said, that is not compatible with ordinary field theory, so you have to add some additional axioms to make point particles special. This has now actually been adapted so that it works, and in fact is proven to work from first principles for arbitrary extended objects in a very general context. So it's no longer an axiom, it's now essentially a theorem that you can do this. And in particular, the theorem looks like this, where if you take definitions of, say, linear momentum or angular momentum for some extended object, and you look at how those things evolve in time, you basically get an answer that is the same as you would get for a test particle, but with the field that you would put into the test particle equations of motion being this homogeneous type field, which is the full field minus the singular field. And all effects of the singular field have, in fact, been absorbed into these little tildes that I've shown here. And the tildes mean that you have a renormalization of the linear momentum, of the angular momentum, and in fact, of all multiple moments of the stress energy tensor. So this is, for example, the quadrupole moment of the stress energy tensor. And these are finite renormalizations, I should say, for any non-singular object. So once you have this kind of thing where you say that really you just have test particle motion in the field phi h, and this also works, this works in scalar fields, electromagnetism, it works in linearized gravity. Once you have that, it's very simple to compute a self-force. So how do you do that? There are many approximations that people use, and explicitly or implicitly. And I want to try to give some flavor of what you need to do to try to get a more explicit answer out. This is not a complete list by any means of what's necessary, but it is. There are a few of the things that I think are interesting and not often discussed. So you need to say that the internal timescales of the body are very slow compared to the light crossing time of the body. So this, you can take this to mean several different things. One in particular is this condition where you say that the center of mass acceleration, I haven't defined center of mass, but I'll just tell you it can be defined and not worry about how, that the center of mass acceleration times, which has units of inverse length, times the distance is going to be a very small number. And what that means physically is that you can't accelerate from zero to nearly the speed of light within a light crossing time. If you strongly violate that condition, you can't do anything, pretty much. You can't define, say, hypersurfaces of simultaneity inside the object, because they will actually start to cross before you get outside of the object. And almost anything that you write down will actually break down. So that's a very important condition. And you certainly can't write down anything simple unless this is very much less than one. But another thing that you need to do is also say that the frequencies of internal oscillations are quite small compared to the light crossing time. If you don't do that, you can imagine an object that's just sitting there, and there's nothing else in the universe, but it starts oscillating in some particular way that it can produce a very strong beam of radiation in one direction and start pushing itself around. This is a self force, but it's not the self force that anybody wants to consider, because it has nothing to do with the external universe and just has to do with some internal mechanism of the body. So you need to exclude these types of things as well. And you do that by saying, essentially, that all important internal frequencies are small compared to the diameter. Now, a third thing that you need to do is to say that the body's diameter is small compared to scales of the external field. So this is something that you should be very familiar with from test body approximations. If you have some extended test object moving around a massive body, say in Newtonian gravity, for example, if that object is very, very small compared to the radial separation, then you can treat it as basically a point object. You only need to worry about its mass interacting with the gravitational field of the central body. If it's larger, you need to worry about its quadrupole moment and then its octupole moment and so on. So in order to avoid doing that, you need to say that the body size is small compared to basically all scales of the external field. This is a test body type assumption. This has nothing to do with test body type assumptions. This is really intrinsically used to simplify the self force. All of this is usually subsumed into saying that the object is small. I think that's a very misleading statement. It's not wrong, because in each of these cases you have a D much less than one, but there are various things in front of the D, and these have different physical interpretations, and you need different assumptions in different problems, and I think these really should be separated conceptually. All right, so you apply these things, and then you use either this kind of method, or you use brute force calculation, or you use some method like matched asymptotic expansions or some variant of that, and you can produce relatively explicit equations of motion. One of these, in electromagnetism, is known as the DeWitt-Brehm equation, as it was first produced by DeWitt and Brehm in 1960, and they actually had a small error that was corrected by Hobbes 8 years later. But this describes the motion of a small in this sense, plus probably a few additional assumptions as well, a small object moving in a fixed background space-time that may be curved, where there's no gravitational back reaction. You just turn off Einstein's equation. When you do that, you find that the center of mass acceleration, so MA, Newton's second law looking thing, is going to be basically the Lorentz force, where your field is the homogeneous field. This is the full field with the singular field subtracted out. You can then basically assume that the full field is some external piece due to other objects in the universe plus the retarded field due to the object itself. And when you do that, you get these additional terms. This is just an expansion of this first thing here. The self force is an action of the body on itself. So there is a factor of q squared here. This is because if you had a charged particle moving in some external field, the force is proportional to q. But if the external field is produced by the body, it is also proportional to q. So you're going to have a q times q in the self force, or a q squared. And this PAB here is just a projection operator that gets you orthogonal to the world line. First term here is a z triple dot, which looks strange, but should really be massaged a little bit before it's taken too seriously. Basically, this gives you runaway solutions that people worry about if you do take it seriously, but using these assumptions, you can't possibly get runaway solutions because you've already excluded them. So this really should be reduced in order, and say if you say that z triple dot, which is the time derivative of the acceleration, is basically just time derivative of the external force being this thing, which is very well behaved, and then you have no problems. But this was calculated originally, essentially by Abraham in 1903. And then generalized to the relativistic version by Dirac in 1938, or actually by Lorentz in 1910 somewhere before that. And that basically just gives you the projection operator here. Curved space-time gives you two things. It gives you this Ricci term, which I don't think should be taken too seriously. But more interestingly, it gives you what's called a tail integral. And that's this thing over here, which is an integral over the past history of the source. The reason for this is that Green's functions in curved space-time, or even some unusual Green's functions in flat space-time, but ordinary Maxwell-type Green's functions in curved space-time will have support not only along light cones, but in the entire past of the light cone. So if you have some object that does a wiggle down here, you can have a field that's going to basically scatter off the curvature and come back and hit the particle again, even though these two points are time-like separated. Whereas in flat space-time, you could only have flat space-time without dielectrics and so on. You can only have connections along light-like rays. But in curved space-time, you have a tail term like this, and this is usually written down as an integral from minus infinity, meaning you go all the way into the infinite past, to right before the object's own time. This S minus means basically go right up to the, take a limit as you approach the object, but don't quite get to it, because otherwise you get infinity. Now, there are several comments that can be made about this, but I think probably the most important one is that this really should not be minus infinity, because none of your approximations really work in infinite time in the past, so you should cut this off at some finite time and produce the rest from basically an initial data hypersurface propagated forward in the usual way. And this is, I think, first explicitly pointed out by Adam Pounds quite recently, actually. One more comment on this is that this self-force, which is what's been written down for now 50 years, is not quite everything that's there in the ordinary kinds of approximations that you want to apply. But there are also some test body effects that people usually don't pay attention to. And these involve the spin of the body as well as the electromagnetic dipole moment of the body. And under usual approximations, these things are comparable to the self-force, and you do need to take them into account. All right, so what is the gravitational version of that equation? It's known as the Mises-Tako equation. It describes a small, massive body moving in a vacuum space-time. and it has no other forces on it. You're not, you don't have an electric field that's accelerating a charged particle, and there's gravitational cell force at the same time, but it's really just a freely falling particle in a vacuum space-time. Then the result of various calculations, which again, use this kind of thing, or use matched asymptotic expansions of various forms, I'll give you an equation of this form, which is basically to say that the object essentially moves on a geodesic in this H metric, which is the full metric minus the singular field metric. So this is something that is actually smooth at the particles, so this derivative operator is well defined, and you can expand it as the derivative operator associated with the background metric, plus the usual difference in Christoffel symbols between two derivative operators. And what appears here, this H superscript H, is the metric perturbation with the singular piece subtracted out once again. Again, one small comment that this is not really a geodesic, but in fact, you have some spin terms as well that show up. Those are not self-force, that's just the Papa-Petru force. In the usual sort of counting, they're the same order. And of course, I've also neglected things that are of order h squared and higher that nobody has figured out yet. Okay, so this is still not a very explicit expression like this one was. In order to find the H-type metric perturbation, the smooth metric perturbation, as I said, you can just subtract off, if you have the full one, you could just subtract off the singular one, which is relatively easy to compute. And this can be rewritten, actually, as a surface integral, if you like. So this is like an angle average. If you do all of these things explicitly and make a small sphere and so on, this looks very much like an angle average. So I want to just make a point that using, in slight contradiction to what something that Sam said yesterday, but I don't think he actually disagrees with what I'm going to say right now, making use of this regularized, I don't really want to use the word regularized because everything should be finite here, this regularized field HH is completely equivalent to doing an angle average. They give you different ways of calculating things, but saying that HS is negligible up to momentum renormalization type effects is exactly the same as saying that the self-force is given by an angle average. Okay. All right. So a little bit more explicitly, you can also say that, well, the metric perturbation is just the retarded field of the object. This is what people usually do. When you assume that, this equation here reduces to this one, where I've now put the background acceleration on one side of the equation instead of just writing this thing entirely as a derivative operator with respect to the H field. I write it as acceleration with respect to the H field. I have acceleration with respect to the background, G bar. And you get an expression like this, where H tail is defined in this way. So in the gravitational case, you don't have these kinds of terms at all. You only have tail types of terms. And the reason for that is the assumption that I mentioned a few minutes ago, which is that the particle is freely falling. There are no ropes pulling on it. There are no other fields that are pulling on it. So at lowest order, the acceleration is zero. You only have really self-force coming in. And so these sorts of things, which are in principle there, are actually higher order. And in order to deal with these, you would actually have to include other terms as well that would probably change the structure of this quite a bit. So even though you could calculate something like this in the gravitational case, it's probably meaningless. So you just subtract that out, and you're left with a tail term. Seem to be some things that are missing from here, but not too important. once again, there's a spin here. And once again, you shouldn't take this to minus infinity, but really cut it off at some finite time in the past. This is especially important in GR, where perturbation is much more subtle. Perturbation theory is much more subtle than it is for, say, Maxwell theory on a fixed background. Okay. So just to summarize a little bit, the Mises-Tocco equation, which is this thing, just to remind you, has now been rigorously derived, and this has been done in several ways. There have been some variants of matched asymptotic expansions, the best ones of which were done by Grolla and Wald in 2008, and then by Pound in 2010, Adam added the methods of singular perturbation theory, which I think greatly improve our confidence in the long-term behavior of this equation, that everything is well-behaved. Alternatively, this kind of approach where you actually take some non-singular matter distribution and you define a world line in it non-perturbatively, and you then use this kind of stuff, has also been used to derive the Mises-Tocco equation. So this is in a vacuum background in linearized gravity. All of these things are in a vacuum background in linearized gravity. And in fact, they're all in Lorentz gauge. And gauge is quite an important issue in gravitational self-force, although I haven't really talked about it. And I don't think I really want to here, because it's a very contentious thing among certain people. But just as a general caution, whenever you're dealing with these equations, you want to really know what your definitions are, and you really want to know what your approximations are, and you want to know what are the things that you're neglecting, or what are the possible things that you're neglecting in your equations. If you don't do this, it's very easy to get yourself confused, because the world lines that you're using are not world lines. They're this strange perturbative thing that you describe using 10 different steps between that and reality. And there may be very few steps between that crazy object and what you actually want to measure, but you need to demonstrate that, not assume that. Another thing that's not mentioned very often is, as I said, that dipole-type effects are comparable to the self-force in the usual, in typical countings that people do. So dipole, in the gravitational case, means spin, because spin is basically the dipole moment of the stress-energy tensor. In the electromagnetic case, it means spin and electric and magnetic dipole moments in the usual sense. And also I want to say that the Mises-Tocco equation is very general. It applies, it made very few assumptions about the background space-time, but it also made very particular approximations, and it's very possible that better methods exist to treat certain problems. For example, if you have a Schwarzschild black hole and you want to look at quasi-circular orbits around it, or a Kerr black hole, or whatever, it's very possible that you can produce methods that are really adapted to that problem and will give you better long-term evolution, will give you things that are much easier to calculate in the end, et cetera. And so an example of this kind of thing is what Hinder and Flanagan are doing with two timescales and orbits around Kerr. But of course, there are other things that could possibly be done. And I want to just finish up with a few open problems in the field. And I'm not really going to say much about how to solve these or anything about how to solve these. But one thing is that gravitational self-force, as it's known now, is only for freely falling objects. So you can't, for example, put in have a charged particle that's being accelerated by an electric field, and you want to know the gravitational self-force at the same time. Nobody knows how to do that right now. So that's one thing that would be very interesting to figure out. Something else is that let's turn off the external forces, but let's look at higher orders. So let's look at really nonlinear gravity and see what happens for the gravitational self-force. There are several reasons that this is very difficult and perhaps is not even a useful or interesting thing to talk about, but I don't know the answer. The reasons that I say that is, first of all, that it becomes much less clear what you mean by self-field when you have a strongly nonlinear theory. What is really the field of this object versus another object? It's all mixed together in reality. And it may not, even if you could come up with a definition, it may not be very useful to go to that much trouble, because there may be just as much work in figuring out all the rest of the stuff in the problem. So that's one thing that is potentially problematic here. Another is that you don't know if the answer is going to be universal, in the sense that this kind of equation did not depend on the internal structure of the object. All you got, the only property of the object you had here was its mass and its world line. But in general, you might have some complicated dependence on internal structure. You might have a difference between black holes and neutron stars, or between one neutron star and another. And maybe you don't, but as far as I know, nobody has demonstrated this either way. And lastly, it may not be possible or useful to introduce world lines anymore, because these objects might be, well, not very interesting. They might be just very contrived things that you put in because you can get an answer out, but they may not be connected in any interesting way to observations that you would like to actually carry out. And again, I don't know that anybody has really looked seriously at this kind of problem. A little bit differently, I think that the Mises-Tocqueville equation is, the errors in it are not well known, especially if you evolve from initial data and look for a very long time. So this has been greatly improved by Adam Pound, as I said, but I think it's still very far from having any sort of quantitative handle on what the long-term accuracy of that equation is. So I think it would be very interesting to figure that out, but I have no idea how, unless you go maybe to very specific cases like circular or quasi-circular orbits around in a particular space-time. But in general, I don't think it's even solvable. And lastly, of course, there are, how do you actually use this in a practical case? Green's functions are very hard to compute in explicit space-time, so what do you actually do? And that's, of course, what many people work on, and there's quite a bit of progress on that, and I think Lior Barak is going to talk about it after the break.
And we've got microphones here. Eric will. And you want to ask some questions by the microphone.
So, if you've got questions, comments. Before we proceed with this, I would like to apologize for the noise, most of the debate. You have to deal with that.
I can't hear what you said.
The mic is supposed to be on.
Hi.
Hello? Okay. I'd like to apologize for the noise, and especially to Abe, because he had to suffer through the noise during his talk. Luis, are we going to move?
So we have two options. One is to stay here, comfy but noisy, or go upstairs, very tight, and less noisy.
I think for this group we're going to be fine, but it might fill up in the course of the day.
Yes, so we can move today, but tomorrow we're going to perhaps have to put up with this.
Anyway, we'll have to make a decision on that.
So you have questions or comments?
Luis, pass on the microphone.
I just wanted to make a comment that regarding the universality part, in my paper with Balak, we have this small section on essentially...
Can you speak louder? I can't hear with the noise.
Oh, even with the mic. So I just wanted to comment on the universality of the self-force regarding, you know, if it's a black hole or neutron star. And in a paper with Balak, we had this small section that demonstrated that, well, you can essentially power count the finite size effects of whatever object you have there, so black hole or neutron, some compact object. And so if you throw, for example, on this world line some induced quadrupole moments from the external background, that that enters into or would contribute to the self or to the motion of the deviation from say the motion at something like third or fourth order in the mass ratio. So it's something that's really quite high, and it's you know, you don't need to worry if it's a neutron star or a black hole or a boson star or whatever up until you start calculating at third or fourth order in the mass ratio.
Okay, so that's for induced quadrupoles and so on, right?
That's right, yeah, which is the leading order finite size effect without spin. If you include spinning effects, then yeah, it changes.
But. Yeah, I'd also be worried about things that can't be written in multiple moments in some way, so something that really involved an integral of the internal structure times some non-analytic function. And I mean, those things could in principle show up, but maybe your argument is sufficient to show that they don't. I don't know.
Yeah, we can talk about it, but okay. Yeah, it essentially just amounts to throwing some Riemann squared type terms on the world line, and these are related to the induced quadrupole moments from the background, and then you can power count those and estimate their effect. So.
More questions, comments?
So I'll just. I'll respond on a couple of points, both not surprisingly involving gauge, which you tried to stay away from, but you didn't quite. So the first comment is that you said, you know, all of these methods of deriving Mises-Tokwa or deriving gravitational self-force are in the Lorentz gauge or
okay,
something.
Okay, I'm sorry, Sam.
Well, yeah, okay, but so at least what we did, you know, really made no gauge choice except for computations, and as I talked about yesterday, that wasn't even a smart gauge choice.
Well, as far as I know, you only made assumptions without assuming a gauge, which...
We made an assumption to find the world line and show that you could always compute it in any gauge that was compatible with our assumptions, and then we computed it in one gauge.
But you had an actual method to compute it, in principle, without...
Yeah. Well, method. I mean, we showed it existed, and we... I don't know. Anyway, as of yesterday, I certainly have computed it in any gauge.
What you talked about yesterday is... different, but yeah. Okay.
Anyway, we don't want it to devolve into an argument, as you said. The other point, really, there's no point in arguing on because it's just viewpoints, and I called it ideology yesterday, but, you know, why I like angle averages more than singular fields. Well, yes, they're equivalent, as you said, in the Lorentz gauge, but the singular field has really only been defined in the Lorentz gauge, and you have to define a different one in some other gauges. So again, for gauge reasons, I prefer the angle average, which holds in any of the log gauges.
Yeah. I agree.
Just to further follow up on the question of the effect or lack thereof of the small body's internal structure. I have a sort of naive question about this. As I understood Thibaut Dumour's review paper in 300 Years of Gravitation, way back in late, I think, 1987, internal structure shows up only at some way high power, which is going to be negligible in practice. Why does that argument not apply in the case that you're talking about?
Okay. I don't remember exactly what Thibaut said, but a couple of comments that I want to make are that, first of all, he was using a post-Newtonian approximation, whereas this is quite different. Second of all, he was considering astrophysical objects that are intrinsically spherical unless they are perturbed by some tidal field or... they're spinning or something like that, whereas a lot of the things I was talking about could involve objects that probably don't exist in any strongly gravitating case, but could exist, where you have very large shear stresses allowed and you could have crazy shapes that are just permanently there. So Thibaut's argument completely fails for that, but of course it wasn't meant for that kind of thing. And also, as far as I remember, that was an argument along the lines of power counting, probably rather similar to what Chad was just referring to, and it was not an actual proof.
Yeah, he called it the self-effacement.
Yeah. I think there was no actual math behind it, but that might be wrong. I don't know.
My recollection is he actually worked out a bit more of the analysis his sort of Gedanken model was a neutron star, and then he talked about how you might generalize it to a black hole where you can't integrate over the interior of the volume. But he called it the self-effacement principle, that the internal structure doesn't matter, and you still have essentially an equivalence principle. Obviously, radiation reaction is a small violation of that, but...
Okay.
I think all of this was at best a plausibility argument that you wouldn't expect internal structure to play a role in that case at some post-Newtonian order, in our case at some power of the mass ratio. But to prove it, even in post-Newtonian theory, requires to calculate all sorts of structure integrals that will in principle appear in the equations of motion but always happen to cancel out in the end. And it's a very, very delicate thing. That happens because, you know, you have all the physical reasons to expect it to happen, but to prove it requires very detailed work, and that's what Abe, I think, was referring to.
Any other questions
or comments? Okay, just one thing, so we have the break.